From the Land to Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 26th day of December 2023. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason out of the office, so no update to the commodity markets. However, we will hear an excerpt from the Farm Assets Conference. Scott Irwin, agricultural economist, made a presentation on renewable diesel. It is a good one, and you'll want to pay particular attention to the policy stack. Speaking of which, if you'd like to see and hear more from Scott, you can do that in person at the Illinois Farm Economic Summits. Those are coming up January 9, 10, and 11 in Mount Vernon, Peoria, and DeKalb. But you do need to sign up. Don't wait. Do that right now today at willag.org or farmdocdaily.illinois.edu.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
I changed your opening slide, but it says the same thing.
This is not my presentation. No, I just kidding. Man,
you really threw me. he said, "This is not my presentation." It's like, it is now. Scott Irwin is going to talk to us about biofuels, the RFS, SAF, renewable diesel, and what the future might look like. Give him a nice warm welcome.
Great to be with you this morning. Really excited to share about this. When Todd suggested the title, I said, why don't you just say everything you should know about biofuels in 30 minutes. Explain the world. So he initially told me 45 minutes. I said, oh, that's too long. And now when I put my presentation together, I'm regretting that choice. So we'll see what we can get through in 30 minutes. And I also realized, after long experience in these kind of settings, is I'm the only thing standing between you and lunch, so I better be good. Okay, so we're just going to go through a series of questions. There'll be a quiz afterwards before you get your food. The question I found, we all need to have a base of understanding in terms of what these animals are. There's a lot of confusion, and so before I can get into any of the data or analysis, I want us to all be on the same footing in terms of some basic facts about the biofuels that are in the news. And the main one we're going to talk about is renewable diesel, okay? I'll bet you've all heard, almost everybody's heard, of renewable diesel, and, you know, it's the next big thing in ag. But what actually is it? How is it made? Well, here's my fancy-dancy graphic to explain renewable diesel. Basically, in the simplest but true terms, you put in waste fats and vegetable oil into a crude oil refinery, and out comes a drop-in biofuel that's called renewable diesel. That essentially is how you make renewable diesel. It is chemically indistinguishable from petroleum diesel. It goes through the same production process. That's what's key. So that it is 100% substitute for petroleum diesel. That's why it's called drop-in. Okay? It takes a lot of heat and chemical catalyst, and you have to crack it. It's a crude oil refinery. So whatever your experience and knowledge about that, apply it to making renewable diesel. Okay. So by way of contrast, something that you may be more familiar with because it's been around longer, FAME biodiesel. Okay, just traditional, old-fashioned biodiesel. How is it made? I didn't know if I had the courage to do this or not, but polyester, 70s. Some of you are nodding out there. You're remembering your leisure suits. I know you are. I see you. I had one. FAME biodiesel, as best I can tell, actually uses the same chemistry as goes into making polyester fiber. So you put in waste fats and veg oil. This is the key. The feedstocks are the same for renewable diesel and FAME biodiesel, but the production technology and what comes out the other end, entirely different. I'm not going to go into the details. I did really bad in chemistry in college. I now regret that, getting into biofuels, but that's another story. But what comes out is FAME biodiesel from this polyester production technology, and the key is it's not a drop-in fuel. It is chemically not the same as petroleum diesel or renewable diesel. So it has to be blended with petroleum diesel. So that's just a brief introduction to the two biofuels that are going to take center stage in my presentation. Okay? So there's been a boom going on in renewable diesel, that first one, okay, the drop-in replacement for petroleum diesel. What do we know about it? Well, the scale of the renewable diesel boom is really something to behold. If you look, you can see that up through 2020, U.S. renewable diesel production was really very, very small, under 1 billion gallons a year. And you consider that the U.S. diesel market's about 55 billion gallons. It's very small. And then you can just see 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, just taking off, a true boom. We're building renewable diesel plants at an impressive pace here in the United States. Now, the number of plants is not as big as that graph makes it seem because these are large. They're petroleum refineries, so the scale is much bigger than a biodiesel plant typically, hundreds and hundreds of millions of gallons. And the total number of plants that are represented on this chart is about 24. So it's not large. So the plants themselves individually on average are very, very large. The things I want you to carry with you, you know, that's a huge increase going from about roughly 1 billion gallons of production capacity annually to potentially after 2025, 7.4 billion gallons. I mean, we're ramping this up, at least based on this projection, really, really rapidly. And notice from 21 to 22, we jumped 1 billion gallons. In 2023, we're scheduled to jump 1.5 billion gallons of production capacity. But the one I really want us to carry forward is 2024. We're scheduled another 1.4 billion gallons of capacity to come online. And that includes one of the world's largest renewable diesel refineries in Rodeo, California. It's a Phillips 66 plant that will have 680 million gallons of renewable diesel production capacity when it comes online. So watching if that actually comes online quite as quickly as is expected. So that's what it is. We're building renewable diesel refineries, and production is ramping up at a very rapid pace. And what's the market impact of that been? This chart shows the crush value of meal and oil, soybean meal and oil at Iowa plants going back a long ways. To the left of the renewable diesel bar, that black vertical line, here's the thing. Forever in my professional career, soybean oil represented about 1/3 of the value of soybeans in the crush, and meal about 2/3. Meal has always dominated the value of a bushel of soybeans. The renewable diesel boom takes off, and look at what happened to soybean oil prices. Bing! Just exploded to the point where in 21 and 22, half the value of your soybeans was coming from the oil. Now, that has since backed off, but we're still at very, very high soybean valuation or soybean oil valuation relative to meal. That's a big impact of the renewable diesel boom. Huge change in the pricing dynamics and market dynamics of the soybean market. Same graph here for soybean prices. Again, these are at Iowa plants. And we see this huge run-up in the price of soybeans that paralleled the run-up in the price of soybean oil. Of course, not all of the increase in the price of soybeans was due to the renewable diesel boom's impact on soybean oil prices, but it definitely was part of the wind behind the sales during since 2021. So this has been big, and it's been economically important right down to the producer level for U.S. soybeans. And of course, it's had a big impact on global markets as well. So then there's knock-on effects. This is data on expansion of soybean crush capacity in the United States because all those renewable diesel plants need feedstock. And one of the biggest ones is soybean oil, not the only one. And we could see that we're in the process of a substantial increase in soybean crushing capacity in the United States. If all of the expansions and new plants get built in the next 4 years, we're scheduled to increase soybean crush capacity by about a third in the U.S. So a lot going on in that in this boom. And then you see analysis like this. This is a Rabobank report from a little over a year ago saying, oh my goodness, renewable diesel needs soybean oil. We need soybean acres. As many as 18 million acres of additional soybeans to provide all that soybean oil that all those renewable diesel plants are going to need. That's the argument. In fact, you've saw other projections as large as 30 million acres of soybeans will be needed. So that ought to get your attention. What's behind the renewable diesel boom?
You're listening to an excerpt of the Farm Assets Conference here on Illinois Public Media. Scott Irwin, agricultural economist, made a presentation on biofuels, particularly renewable diesel. And he just gotten to the point of asking, what's driving the renewable diesel push?
This is going to be really interesting. It ain't the market. This chart shows the price of biodiesel going all the way back to 2007. In the blue line, I'm using biodiesel because renewable diesel markets are much smaller and there's not as much price reporting, so I'm using as a substitute here biodiesel. But I do know this, an important point when you see this chart, renewable diesel is more expensive than FAME biodiesel. So if I had a blue line for renewable diesel, it'd be even higher. The red line is ULSD, ultra-low sulfur diesel. So that's diesel prices at the wholesale level, adjusted for equivalent energy level of FAME biodiesel and renewable diesel. And there is a yawning gap between biodiesel and, by implication, renewable diesel prices and energy. Averages roughly $1.50 to $2 higher. And since the renewable diesel boom has taken off, that gap has gotten as big as $5 a gallon. This stuff is expensive to make. It's a fact. And as you try to make more of it and you bid up the feedstocks, it gets even more expensive to make. Facts. So why in the heck are we seeing this enormous boom in building renewable diesel plants? Because I didn't mention this planner, the plant that, imagine, building a crude oil refining facility is expensive. Billions to build these things. This is the way I summarize it. This is my simplest possible view of the supply and demand fundamentals for the renewable diesel market. Standard supply curve, and then I have a perfectly flat demand curve because it's a substitute for petroleum diesel. So it has to sell for the same price as petroleum diesel, or you would not buy any of it. So that's why it's flat. But notice, there's no intersection of the supply and demand curves, which means the market's solution for renewable diesel is a big, fat zero. The market says we need zero. So it's all about the policy. All about the policy. In fact, I've invented a new term that to describe a market like renewable diesel. It's a policy market, because without policy incentives, none of it sells. That's not a popular characterization, but it is the economic truth. And I talked to a lot of investment bankers that are involved in this sector, and I love their words that they use. They love to invent words and labels, and so they call it the policy stack. Now just think about that for a minute, you know, disentangle that. That just cracks me up. First off, as kind of hiding what's going on here, because what you're doing is you're stacking subsidies. That's what they mean. And so they want to know how big is your policy stack before they invest. So let's talk about the policy stack for renewable diesel. The first, and by far and away the most important, is the U.S. Renewable Fuel Standard, which provides minimum volumetric standards or mandates for biofuel use. Okay? That's been around for a long time, and it is still the most important foundation of the policy stack for renewable diesel. But there's more. There's the U.S. Blenders Tax Credit, or BTC, which gives a $1 per gallon credit for each gallon of renewable diesel and FAME biodiesel blended with diesel. It's been around for a long time. It's getting converted to a new metric based on carbon intensity scoring after 2024. And there's more. This is like, you know, one of those TV late night infomercials. We also have very high import tariffs to provide duties on the biggest U.S. import competitors for FAME biodiesel, which, of course, since FAME and renewable diesel compete for the same market space, that's an indirect subsidy for renewable diesel. But wait, there's more. There are state FAME biodiesel blend mandates in a variety of forms. State vehicles in Illinois that are diesel mandated to use biodiesel blends. And Minnesota, they have an actual mandate. So there's all sorts of that stuff out there. But wait, there's still more. And this is the real wild card, state low carbon fuel credits. Okay? This is called, how many of you have heard of the LCFS? LCFS. Okay. It's okay. It is new. That stands for the Low Carbon Fuel Standard. It started in California. And it offers variable credits for supplying low carbon fuel into a state's fuel market. California is the biggest. Oregon and Washington have added them. There's a significant effort to get one added in Illinois. Minnesota is fairly far down this road as well. New York, but so far they haven't passed. So that's a pretty darn impressive policy stack. And this is 100% the reason for the renewable diesel boom. Take any of these pieces away, it's like Jenga. It doesn't work. So, next, where is the renewable diesel boom headed? And I'm going to warn you ahead of time, we're going back to class. Okay? So buckle up, buttercups. You're going to see some supply and demand charts. Okay? But trust me, it's going to be worth the 5 minutes because it's going to provide a blindingly important insight that all of these super fancy and incredibly well-paid investment bankers missed. Okay, so that's my version of the renewable diesel market, supply and demand. Okay, big fat zero. Okay, think of this as the big fat zero graph. So we put an RFS volume mandate out there in that market. I just arbitrarily made it the red line. That's basically a law that says you have to use that much renewable diesel. Okay? Don't make it any more complicated. That's all it is. Well, economically, it makes the demand curve look like that L. By law, you have to have this minimum, and so you get this funny L-shaped demand curve. Well, how are you going to get that much renewable diesel produced? Renewable diesel producers have to have the supply price. That has to be the market price they receive. But consumers are not mandated. They get to say, well, if you want me to consume all that renewable diesel at that mandated quantity, my demand price is diesel. That's what I'll pay. And this creates that gap I showed you of actual price differences. The difference between the supply price and the demand price has got to be made up somehow. So how does this work? Houston, we have a problem. In the RFS, there is something called a RIN, Renewable Identification Number. It is a credit that has a value, and it represents the gap between the supply price and the demand price. We could go deep down that wormhole. Trust me, I know nobody wants to do that. But just know that's how it works. So just know when you set a mandate way above what the market wants, the RIN price will be positive because somebody's got to make up the gap. Okay, so let's look. On the left is the actual history of RIN prices for biodiesel, renewable diesel. A lot of volatility. We don't care about that. Look at the scale. Generally between 50 cents and $2. The message from the market, the RIN market, is in the real world, since 2009 on that great data, we've been operating on that vertical portion of the demand curve. That's what it tells us. And here's where you get the money point for the morning. Yeah, we usually think of a mandate as providing a minimum. And it does. By law, you can't use less than that. But it also economically creates a maximum or a ceiling. There's no market incentive for anybody to go above that mandate either. That is what all the investment bankers missed.
That was part one of the presentation Scott Irwin, agricultural economist from the University of Illinois, made to the audience at the Farm Assets Conference on December the 15th in Champaign. Let's continue now with part two.
Renewable diesel and FAME biodiesel in the RFS. I'm going to go through this pretty quick because Todd's going to kick me out of here. In the RFS, renewable diesel and FAME fill three buckets. There's a biodiesel mandate. There's something called an undifferentiated advance mandate, and which is the excess of the advance mandate above the biodiesel mandate. These are just details, so we don't need to get deep into it. And something called the conventional gap. This really makes the corn guys mad. Here's the cool thing you can do. If you know that the RFS mandate for FAME and renewable diesel is binding, all you have to do is go look up the numbers and you know the maximum size of the renewable diesel, FAME biodiesel market because of what I just showed you. Just go figure it out. Anybody can do this. It's just simple arithmetic. And it turns out that number, depending on a couple minor assumptions, is between 4 and 4.5 billion gallons a year. The RFS sets that number. The Biden administration, in their rulemaking for 23, 24, and 25 that came out earlier this year, set that. Okay, so keep that in mind. We're going to compare that now to the production capacity that's being built. So this is official data. So going back to the beginning of 2022, the red is the operating FAME biodiesel capacity, and the blue is the operating renewable diesel operating capacity. Add them up. The yellow is my 4 to 4.5 billion gallons. And Houston, we've really got a problem now because our capacity currently is outweighing the demand ceiling established by the RFS. Something has got to give. Remember that number from the beginning of my presentation? 1.4 billion gallons, that 680 million gallon P66 plant in Rodeo, California coming on next year. It's going to just get, imagine next year that the top of that bar is going to go above 7 billion gallons. Something has to give. Either some of these renewable diesel plants are not going to come online, or they're going to operate way below capacity, and or FAME biodiesel plants have to be driven out of business, or they have to be producing at a rate far below their capacity. Because what all those fancy investment bankers missed, the yellow bar ain't changing. Once the Biden administration issued that rulemaking, it's fixed. It's a final rulemaking. It ain't gonna change. Now, these are long-term investments, so they can maybe say, oh, well, we'll survive until we get a new set of rulemakings in 2026 and forward, but whoops, we gotta survive till then. So there is, in my opinion, in the next 2 years, a major reckoning and rationalization that has to happen between these two trends. Something has to give. And so this makes me unusual in talking about the renewable diesel boom, is that this is my sense of where it's headed. One way or another, the market is going to force actual renewable diesel and FAME biodiesel production together to be within that yellow band. And trust me, I have had some interesting conversation with investment bankers who have been putting money into this sector. And some of them very heated when I make my argument. I will just admit it. Most of them don't believe it, but they have no counter argument either. So, unfortunately, I have to leave out SAF because I stupidly did not extend my presentation to 45 minutes, and I want to be on time, Todd.
You know what?
They want to see it. Keep going.
What?
SAF.
Do you really want to see SAF?
Raise your hand. You want to
see
sustainable aviation fuel?
Oh. No.
Make it quick.
Okay, quick. What is sustainable aviation fuel, which is much in the news? This is my super fancy graphic to explain sustainable aviation fuel. You get it? Literally, this is about what you do. When you start with, you go down the waste fats and veg oils method, this is pretty much what you do. It's actually called making Arctic diesel. You have to refine it twice because you have to lower the cloud point of the fuel, of the kerosene-like. Jet fuel is basically kerosene that has a cloud point, which is the point at which it freezes, that is low enough that you can fly at 35,000 feet and it doesn't freeze. Well, that's what you do with renewable diesel to make sustainable aviation fuel. You just have to refine it twice to get that cloud point down. You can also start by, I would say in pilot stage, the idea of making sustainable aviation fuel from ethanol. But that's another whole story. But this is what I want to get, here's what people tell me. Okay, Irwin, you're ridiculously bearish on renewable diesel and that outlook, but we're going to be saved by sustainable aviation fuel. That's what's going to power grain prices, and that's going to take over if the renewable diesel boom fails. Okay. This is the size of the current U.S. jet fuel market. It's kind of been flat around 24, 25 billion gallons. So it is a frickin' big market potential in the long run for replacement by basically biofuels in the sky. That's what I like to call it. And, okay, but notice I put my scale there in red. It's billion gallons. This is the amount of sustainable aviation fuel we are currently making. Notice the scale, million gallons. I can't even put that on this graph. It's so small. It's effectively nothing. It is the definition of a technology in its infancy. If it ever really takes off, it will be way in the future. I actually agree with my friends in the corn and the soybean industry pushing sustainable aviation fuel and policy incentives. This is the future, I believe, with the threat from electrical vehicles to gasoline demand in the long run. I really believe this is the future direction that policy should go. This is the place where demand for liquid fuel is going to be the firmest in the long run. The way I like to put it, for those of you that are Star Trek fans like I am, until we get dilithium crystals, we're going to be pouring liquid fuel into airplanes. I know there's all this stuff about electric airplanes. They say your flight is ready to board, and it's an electrical airplane. I'm backing up. You can all go first on the first electric plane. I ain't going on there. Just all kidding aside, that's just to demonstrate this is a really solid long-term market for biofuels. This is the place, I think, strategically to focus on. But my point is, we have hardly even gotten to the starting line. It's not going to be a large impact on our ag markets certainly for 5 years, and it may take 10 years. And that all depends on a lot of different factors that I don't have time to talk about, Todd.
All right. Thank you. Give Scott a nice round of applause. Scott, flip to the next slide for me, please.
Oh, yeah, I forgot.
He does have one more thing to say.
I do. A professor always has one more thing to say. Ask my wife. That we have I've been writing with a PhD student, Maria Gavini, and Todd Hubbs, who many of you know is now at the ERS, a series of Farm Doc Daily articles on the renewable diesel boom. You just go to Farm Doc Daily, go to series, Renewable Diesel Boom Archive, and you can see all of our articles. I was working late on our latest one, which will be out next Wednesday.
So excellent.
We are working busily away.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Scott. Scott Irwin is an agricultural economist on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the U of I. You can find a whole bunch of stuff from him on the renewable diesel and some on SAF. Thank you, Scott, for finishing up. Yes, sir, we have a question apparently for you. Yes, go ahead.
George, we finally meet.
How did George?
George and I have been going back and forth on email for years, and I had no idea you were going to be here.
No.
This is the really smart guy right here. He knows what he's talking about.
George is George Hoekstra. He's in the audience and president of Hoekstra Trading. He retired from BP in 2009. That was after 35 years in refinery process research and technology management with BP and Amoco. And since then, he's offered consulting services to independent refiners.
Well, thanks. I have a question for you, Scott. Do you have any evidence that anybody like in the Phillips 66 C-suite or any of the other guys are even aware of what you said about something has to give?
I've thought about that a lot because, you know, you ordinarily think of the C-suite, you know, that level, they're super sophisticated, super smart people, and I can't help but think that they understand this and their response is, we're just going to power through it. Or is this one of those situations where they got basically caught with their pants down? I don't know.
I don't think they understand what you explained here.
But, so this is the real test, I'm telling you. George is a very well-known and prominent consultant to the crude oil refining business. That's what he does. I did not know he was going to be here today, so thank you. I'm honored. Do you think I got it right?
Oh, yes. I think you got it right. Absolutely. And I think they're completely unaware,
really,
of what might happen if the volume actually grows. Now, let me ask you one other question, Scott. What do you think is the probability that the actual production volume will exceed the mandate in the next 2 years?
100%.
Okay.
No, I mean,
they don't know what they're facing. They still don't understand what happened when the D6 RIN exploded from 2 cents to a dollar.
I tried to explain it to him. Just read my Farm Doc Daily articles.
I know. There's plenty of explanations out there, but for some reason, this is something that they have just stayed away from. And I think they're going to continue to produce, even if they're not making money.
Well, and you know, maybe they have a longer term horizon.
Phillips invested, I think, $1.2 billion. To convert that refinery.
In Rodeo.
In Rodeo, right.
These are huge investments.
I don't think they did it for profits. I really think when push comes to shove, it was not an economic decision. I think it was driven by corporate policy and political pressure and a distaste for investing in what they have traditionally invested in, which is production of fossil-based fuel, diesel, gasoline, okay? So, and historically, I mean, like they shut down a refinery not too long ago in Alliance in Louisiana. That refinery wasn't profitable for many, many years. It was known to be an unprofitable refinery. They just kept running it because it's not easy to shut down a refinery. And they had an excuse to shut it down because of a flood. So they just didn't start it up again. So it's not like, they're not like a farmer or a biodiesel producer, where as soon as they go they start producing, you know, negative margin product, they shut down tomorrow. No. Maybe farmers do. But anyway, what I'm saying is I don't think that the economics of the situation is really driving everything.
It seems obvious to me as an economist. Thank you, George. There's a question.
Thank you, George. Yes. Once the refineries are built, can they change feedstocks? If they cannot, do they have to rebuild?
There's a lot of variation in the answer to the question of what is the flexibility of a renewable diesel refinery. My understanding is that they can be converted back to process crude oil. George could probably, I don't know how
much. He says yes.
They have to change the catalyst, they have to clean everything out. I don't know exactly how costly that is, but it has some cost.
This is a CVR refinery. They took one particular unit and converted it from producing regular fuels to renewable diesel.
Right.
They can switch that back, and they might in a short period of time.
How short? I'm not sure. I've always wondered how short and how expensive is it to switch back for like CVR?
They can do it in less than 6 months.
Okay.
And it's not very expensive, except for the downtime required.
Okay.
But now other cases, like I don't think that $1.2 billion investment in Rodale, I don't think that refinery is just going to turn around and start up on fuel again. I think if they don't make it viable, that refinery might shut down eventually.
Amazing.
So it's kind of like an alternative to for a refinery that's not profitable anyway.
And some people, another answer to your question is that, can a renewable diesel refinery just start producing SAF? They can't, at least my understanding. They have to have further investment in that second distilling tower and different catalysts and processes different. People I've talked to says, you know, that runs in the hundreds of millions of dollars. So that does not happen quickly or cheaply, but it can be done unless they pre-built it to do all that.
Okay, so the question is, if you took the stack away, how much does that save the United States government? And how much does it cost the soybean producer in price?
I don't have a good answer for that off the top of my head. Never really actually thought about it. It's a great question. The biodiesel tax credits, probably at least $3 or $4 billion right there for the biodiesel tax credit. It's hard to, if you take the RIN value times.
Come back at the Illinois Farm Economics Summit, and we will have an answer to that question in January.
It's probably in the tens of billions, easily. How much
on a bushel of beans?
Probably at least a buck right now.
If he changes his mind, we'll know the answer after the question or in
January.
I'm
just really doing rapid calculations there that typically are really wrong when I do them that fast.
What I liked is that he could actually sit there and do that rapid calculation. I was thinking, how does he pull that off? Thank you, Scott. I appreciate it. George, thank you, too. I appreciate that as well.
You've been listening to Scott Irwin's Renewable SAF Biofuels RFS discussion from the Farm Assets Conference, May December the 15th at the I Hotel in Urbana-Champaign on the campus of the University of Illinois. If you'd like to hear more from Scott, you can do that during the Illinois Farm Economic Summits. Those are coming up January 9, 10, and 11 in Mount Vernon, Peoria, and DeKalb. Register today at willag.org or farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason.